Welcome back, folks, to Futuristic Feminists. I'm your host, Michelle Mullett. Hey, it's been a while. I've been running for office, and everything was going great till some kind of global pandemic. So now I'm at home, safe with my family, and just kind of hunkered down and figured I might as well go back to the podcast. And one thing that happened recently is that my husband bought a monograph of Wes Anderson movies, and the introduction was written by Michael Chabon, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of, you know, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay and Summerland and some other stuff. So when I read this essay, it was so perfect and so perfectly timed for what we're going through, and just so beautiful and poignant that I thought, okay, I should just really record this and make that an episode and kind of a bridge between this kind of hiatus that I took and picking back up and moving on from the campaign and thinking about the future of what this podcast is and what I plan to do in the next few months. So yeah, that's what it looks like right now. The campaign is not over. I do want to add that. I'm definitely still on the ballot and moving forward. But right now, you know, I like to joke that, you know, the 1 year I decide to run for office, be a politician, you know, it's easy. It'll be fun, they said. You know, kiss babies, shake hands. And coronavirus is like, don't kiss babies, don't shake hands, stay in your house for 3 months. So on that note, here's Michael Chabon with the introduction essay to Wes Anderson's movies. The world is so big, so complicated, so replete with marvels and surprises that it takes years for most people to begin to notice that it is also irretrievably broken. We call this period of research childhood. There follows a program of renewed inquiry, often involuntary, into the nature and effects of mortality, entropy, heartbreak, violence, failure, cowardice, duplicity, cruelty, and grief. The researcher learns their histories and their bitter lessons by heart. Along the way, he or she discovers that the world has been broken for as long as anyone can remember, and struggles to reconcile this fact with the ache of cosmic nostalgia that arises. From time to time in the researcher's heart, an intimation of vanished glory, of lost wholeness, a memory of the world unbroken. We call the moment at which this ache first arises adolescence. The feeling haunts people all their lives. Everyone, sooner or later, gets a thorough schooling in brokenness. The question becomes what to do with the pieces. Some people hunker down atop the local pile of ruins and make do. Bedouins tending their goats in the shade of shattered giants. Others set about breaking what remains of the world into bits ever smaller and more jagged, kicking through the rubble like kids running through piles of leaves. And some people, passing among the scattered pieces of that great overturned jigsaw puzzle, start to pick up a piece here, a piece there, with a vague yet irresistible notion that perhaps something might be done about putting the thing back together again. Two difficulties with this latter scheme at once present themselves. First of all, we have only ever glimpsed, as if through half-closed lids, the picture on the lid of the jigsaw puzzle box. Second, no matter how diligent we have been about picking up pieces along the way, we will never have anywhere near enough of them to finish the job. The most we can hope to accomplish with our handful of salvaged bits, the bittersweet harvest of observation and experience, is to build a little world of our own. A scale model of that mysterious original, unbroken, half-remembered. Of course, the worlds we build out of our store fragments can only be approximations, partial and inaccurate. As representations of the vanished whole that haunts us, they must be accounted failures. And yet, in that very failure, in their gaps and inaccuracies, they may yet be faithful maps, accurate scale models of this beautiful and broken world. We call these scale models works of art. In their set design and camera work, their use of stop motion maps and models, Wes Anderson's films readily, even eagerly, concede the miniature quality of the worlds he builds. And yet these worlds span continents and decades. They comprise crime, adultery, brutality, suicide, the death of a parent, the drowning of a child, moments of profound joy and transcendence. Vladimir Nabokov, his life cleaved by exile, created a miniature version of the homeland he would never see again and tucked it with a jeweler's precision into the housing of John Shade's miniature epic of family sorrow. Anderson, who has suggested that the breakup of his parents' marriage was a defining experience of his life, adopts a Nabokovian procedure with the families, or quasi-families at the heart of all his films, from Rushmore forward, creating a series of scale model households that, like the Zemplas and Estodolans and other lost kingdoms of the sea in Nabokov, intensify our experience of brokenness and loss by compressing them. That is the paradoxical power of the scale model. A child holding a globe has a more direct, more intuitive grasp of the Earth's scope and variety, of its local vastness and its cosmic tininess, than a man who spends a year in circumnavigation. Grief at full scale is too big for us to take in. It literally cannot be comprehended. Anderson, like Nabokov, understands that distance can increase our understanding of grief, allowing us to see it whole. But distance does not, ought not necessarily imply withdrawal. In order to gain sufficient perspective on the pain of exile and the murder of his father, Nabokov did not, in writing Pale Fire, step back from them. He reduced their scale and let his patience, his precision, his mastery of detail, detail the god of the model maker, do the rest. With each of his films, Anderson's total command of detail, both the physical detail of his sets and costumes and the emotional detail of the uniformly beautiful performances he elicits from his actors, has enabled him to increase the persuasiveness of his own family without sacrificing any of the paradoxical emotional power that distance affords. Anderson's films have frequently been compared to the boxed assemblages of Joseph Cornell, and it's a useful comparison, as long as one bears in mind that the crucial element in a Cornell box is neither the imagery and objects it deploys, nor the romantic narratives it incorporates and undermines, nor the playfulness and precision with which its objects and narratives have been arranged. The important thing in a Cornell box is the box. Cornell always took pains to construct his boxes himself. Indeed, the box is the only part of a Cornell work literally made by the artist. The box to Cornell is a gesture. It draws a boundary around the things it contains, and it forces them into a defined relationship, not merely with each other, but with everything on the far side of the box. The box sets out the scale of a ratio. It mediates the halves of a metaphor. It makes explicit in plain, handcrafted wood and glass the yearning of a model maker to analogize the world. At the same time, it frankly emphasizes the limitations, the confines of his or her ability to do so. The things in Anderson's films that recall Cornell boxes, the strict, steady, four-square construction of individual shots by which the cinematic frame becomes a Cornellian gesture, a box drawn around the world of the film, the teeming, gridded, curio cabinet sets at the heart of Life Aquatic, Darjeeling, and Mr. Fox, are often cited as evidence of his work's artificiality, at times with the implication, simple-minded and profoundly mistaken, that a high degree of artifice is somehow inimical to seriousness, to honest emotion, to so-called authenticity. All movies, of course, are equally artificial. It's just that some are more honest about it than others. In this important sense, the hand-built model kit artifice on display behind the pane of an Anderson box is a guarantor of authenticity. Indeed, I would argue that artifice openly expressed is the only true authenticity an artist can lay claim to. Anderson's films, like the boxes of Cornell or the novels of Nabokov, understand and demonstrate that the magic of art, which renders beauty out of brokenness, disappointment, failure, decay, even ugliness and violence, is authentic only to the degree that it attempts to conceal neither the bleak facts nor the tricks employed in pulling off the presto change-up. It is honest only to the degree that it builds its precise and inescapable box around its maker's scale version of the world. "For my next trick," says Joseph Cornell or Vladimir or Wes, "I have put the world into a box." And when he opens the box, you see something dark and glittering and orderly, mess of shards, refuse, bits of junk and feather and butterfly wing, tokens and totems of memory, maps of exile, documentation of loss. And you say, leaning in, "The world."